This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. President Trump was back in Ohio, where he was to tout the success of a tank factory. But all the headlines are about what he said regarding the late Senator John McCain. Why is the president so intent on continuing this narrative? And the Democratic field of presidential hopefuls is larger yet. Those topics and more with a full hour of chat about national politics with the political junkie Ken Rudin, who joins us on the phone. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Michael.
NWVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson is here in the studio. Welcome back, Howard.
Thank you, sir.
If you've got questions or comments about the politics shaping the nation, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there. As always, we start this monthly segment with a trivia question. Ken, what is it this time?
And as always, it's a convoluted question, but here it is. Okay. Since World War II, what sitting senator had the highest vote percentage of any presidential candidate but lost the election in November?
Since World War II, what sitting senator got the highest vote percentage in November but failed to win the presidency?
Right.
Okay. If you know the answer, give us a call, 513-419-7100. Ken, if they win, tell them what they get.
They win an unbelievably valuable political junkie campaign button.
Oh, man, you got to have that. 513-419-7100 if you know the answer. Okay, let's get started because President Trump was back in Ohio. He was in Lima to tout some economic success, but he also took some time to attack Senator John McCain again. McCain died last year. Trump said he was never thanked for giving McCain a state funeral, which, of course, the president was not invited to. He's criticized McCain before, saying he prefers heroes who didn't get captured. McCain was a POW in Vietnam. But Trump spent several minutes at this event dissing McCain. So let's talk first about what is the president's motivation here, Ken?
Well, I think the two words that sums it up the best, I think, is March Madness. I mean, this is this is absolutely remarkable. Obviously, it goes back. Obviously, anybody who ever insults Donald Trump, and John McCain had some things about Donald Trump in 2015 when he said that he inspires crazy with his crazies with his rhetoric about immigrants and things like that. So once McCain said that, that led to Donald Trump saying, well, he wasn't a hero because I like heroes are not people who get captured. But then, I mean, and since going back to the weekend when he started tweeting about John McCain, who has been dead for 7 months, he talked about the fact that he did the famous thumbs down on repealing the Affordable Care Act. He said that he had the so-called Steele dossier that he gave to the FBI instead of giving it to him. And he said, I never liked him. And the thing yesterday in Lima, which is so remarkable, so, I mean, I hate to use the word unbelievable because for 2.5 years, I've been saying unbelievable, and it's not unbelievable anymore. But to say that I didn't get a thank you for arranging his funeral, well, of course, it was Congress who arranged the funeral. Matter of fact, Donald Trump gave only a limited flag at half-mast proclamation that was less than most people get. So the disappointment, the bitterness continues with Trump. And, of course, once you insult him, He never forgets.
And Howard, Trump was in Ohio, a state that he carried a couple of years ago, and he made these remarks. What do you see his motivation as being?
I'm with Ken. I mean, it's inexplicable. He was there at the Lima tank plant. It's the last plant in the United States that makes tanks for the military. And he managed to get $714 million into the Pentagon budget to do work on the Abrams M1 tank, and it might mean a lot of jobs for Ohio. And the whole thing was supposed to be about manufacturing jobs and growing jobs and bringing jobs back to Ohio. And instead, he's got this whole room full of tank factory workers. He gives them this rant about John McCain. And that's not what they came there to hear, I'm sure. I know they applauded him.
So how does this play out within the Republican Party? You're seeing some Republican senators, members of Congress, yes, speak out directly against the president's words, but some softer criticism from people like Senator Mitch McConnell, who just touted, you know, all the good that he saw McCain as having done. Lindsey Graham, who was Senator McCain's best buddy, but has also allied himself very closely with President Trump, also said very favorable words about McCain without directly criticizing President Trump. How, Howard, does this play out within the ranks of the Republican Party if Donald Trump continues to speak ill of people that they cared about?
I think if he continues to do this with John McCain and John McCain's legacy, it's up to the Republicans in the Senate to tell him to, look, move on, stop it, it's over. This was, you know, years ago. This is no longer relevant. You can hold a grudge for the rest of your life if you want to, but there's no point in it.
And Ken, I want to ask, how do you think this impacts rank and file Republican voters? These are the same voters who nominated McCain in 2008 before nominating Trump in 2016. Is this one of those situations, like Trump said before being elected, that he could walk out in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and wouldn't lose any voters?
Well, the Republican Party in 2008 is nothing like the way it is in 2019. It doesn't resemble it in any way possible. The thought of a John McCain being nominated by the Republican Party in today's day and age is just unthinkable and just incredible. You mentioned that Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, they all said nice things about John McCain, but no criticism of Trump. There was only one, well, actually there were two senators. Johnny Isaacson, the Republican from Georgia, gave an interview with Georgia Public Broadcasting, who called it deplorable. And he says it's inexcusable and deplorable. And if Donald Trump is going to continue doing this, I will continue to call him out on it. But Johnny Isaacson's the only one who did that. Mitt Romney offered a tweet saying it was just, you know, just awful. And why are you doing this? But everybody else who stood up for John McCain, nobody said anything about the president, and they're fearful of doing that. I mean, you think of the vote last week on the Republican effort to overturn President Trump's national emergency deal. Only of the 20 senators who are running for re-election next year, only one, Susan Collins of Maine, voted against the president. Everybody else who promised they would vote against the president, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, they all caved and voted with the president. So I don't see, you know, that famous quote in 2015 about Fifth Avenue, you know, and people would support me. That hasn't changed. And I think Republican senators know that.
On NPR's Morning Edition today, anchor Rachel Martin asked McCain friend and writing partner Mark Salter, why does Trump keep insulting a dead man? To which Salter replied, quote, I don't know. I'm not a child psychologist.
And you know something? That reminds me of exactly what George Conway, one of his other targets, the president's targets of tweets, not only Saturday Night Live with Jeanine Pirro, but George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband. We don't know how for long, but I mean, he said basically that President Trump is deranged and has some psychological disorder. And again, once you say that about somebody, the president will go on and rant about that.
We'll pick up the conversation on George Conway in just a moment. 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got Paul on the line. Hey, Paul, what's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. I wonder if one of the panelists could address the possibility that the president is intentionally stoking outrage or muddying the waters because the rumors are that the Mueller report is going to be coming out soon.
Great question, Paul. We'll hang up and let the guys answer. So he wants to know if whether this Trump tweeting and commenting on McCain or other issues like George Conway is to divert attention away from the upcoming Mueller report. Howard.
I think that's a possibility, but we just don't know. It may also be a reaction to Trump's anxiety over what Mueller is going to come up with, and that this is his way of changing the subject. I just don't know at this point.
And Ken, I guess you have to wonder, does the president really deploy any strategy at all with his communications? Is he just impulsive?
No, I mean, I understand Paul's question, but I really don't think he's doing it as a distraction or trying to point attention away from Mueller. First of all, President Trump has been doing this from day one. He's been doing it even before he was sworn in as president. So everybody says, well, it's a distraction from something else. This is Donald Trump. This is what he lives for. Even if he's mocked for insane tweets. I mean, he attacked Saturday Night Live, which was a rerun. I mean, the only thing reason I would attack it because it was a rerun. How dare you put it on a rerun? But the fact is that he'll say it's not funny. And the FCC and the Federal Elections Commission, which has nothing to do with it, but is that they should look into Saturday Night Live. It reminds me of that Devin Nunes comment the other day that he's suing Twitter for $250 million because there's a fake Twitter account called Nunes Cow, Nunes Cow that's mocking him, and so he's suing Twitter. I mean, for somebody who just sends out inflammatory and unbelievable tweets for his entire presidency, I don't think it's a distraction. I think it's him.
Well, there's also a new Twitter account called Nunes Skin, and its latest tweet just says, still thin. 513-419-7100 if you want to join us. Today's trivia question is, Ken, give it to us.
Since World War II, what sitting senator had the highest vote percentage in November, but not enough to win?
So which sitting senator since World War II who ran for president got the highest vote percentage in November, but did not get elected president? You can call us, give us your answers, and you'll win a prize. Ken, tell us again what that prize is.
A political junkie button worth over a dollar in postage alone.
More national politics about the president and the Democrats who are looking to replace him coming up after this short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's our monthly look at national politics. And here with us on the phone is the political junkie, Ken Rudin. And in the studio is WVXU senior political analyst, Howard Wilkinson. The number to call if you'd like to weigh in on these issues is 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there. A reminder that we've got our trivia question here from Ken. Since World War II, what sitting senator got the highest vote percentage in November but failed to win the presidency? Give us your answer at 513-419-7100. And hey, Ken, you started to mention this before our break, George Conway. This has got to be another awkward moment in the White House because George Conway is a Republican attorney. He happens to be the husband of Kellyanne Conway, who is a White House senior advisor and advisor to President Trump, off in the face of the administration on the Sunday talk shows, on cable as well during the week. So imagine your boss attacking your spouse and your spouse attacking your boss so relentlessly. What does this tell us about the state of things at the White House?
How about the state of the Conway marriage? That'll be interesting. I would love to be a fly on the wall in their bedroom, but then I changed my mind. I don't want to be in their bedroom at all. But the fact is that Conway, who's a loyal Republican, who was a big supporter of Donald Trump, but he's watched Donald Trump for 2.5 years, and basically he's called him psychologically unfit and things like that. And again, with Donald Trump, if you insult him, and look, a lot of it, Donald Trump didn't start the feud with John McCain. He responded to a comment by John McCain. But when you criticize him, you're continually insulted and berated for the rest of time. Whereas otherwise, if you say nice things about him, he'll be your best friend. If you're an autocratic leader in some other country, if you say, I like Donald Trump, like the president of Brazil, the Donald Trump of South America. Donald Trump says, now I'm going to love him forever because he's associated with Donald Trump. It's just remarkable.
It is indeed. A reminder of our trivia question. Since World War II, what sitting senator got the highest vote percentage in November but failed to win the presidency? The number is 513-419-7100. We've got a few on the line. Let's check in with Aaron. Hey, Aaron, what's your guess for today's trivia question?
I guess Ted Kennedy.
Aaron's guessing Ted Kennedy. Ken.
Well, Ted Kennedy did run for president in 1980, but he was not on the ballot in November. He lost the Democratic nomination to President Carter. He never made it that far.
Good guess, Aaron. Nice try. Let's see who else we've got on the line. We've got Dave. Hey, Dave, what's your guess?
Al Gore.
Al Gore. Ken.
Well, Al Gore certainly came close to the presidency in 2000, but he was not a sitting senator. He was the vice president of the United States.
Ah, that's the key, sitting senator. Good guess, Dave. Appreciate the call. Let's go to David. He's on the line. David, what's your guess?
Senator Robert Dole.
Senator Robert Dole.
That's a great guess, but people forget this. When Robert Dole, when Bob Dole was running for the presidency, he decided in June of 1996 to resign from the Senate. He wanted nothing to do with it. He wanted to be, because the Democrats were mocking him for all these votes in the Senate, he quit the Senate. So when he was the Republican nominee in 96, he was no longer a member of the Senate.
Tricky, tricky. Good guess, David. Let's go to Bill. Hey, Bill, what's your guess? Do we have Bill on the line? Hey, Bill, how are you? What's your guess?
My guess is Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney.
Well, Mitt Romney did run for president in 2012, but he was the Republican nominee, but he wasn't elected to the Senate until 2018. Back then, he was a former governor of Massachusetts, not a senator.
All right. Good guess, Bill. We appreciate the call. Again, 513-419-7100. The question is, since World War II, what sitting senator got the highest vote percentage in November but failed to win the presidency?
These are great guesses. These are great guesses.
Yeah, a lot of great guesses. So let's move on. Let's talk about the Mueller report. We're always hearing it's near, it's close, it's coming, or whatever. We don't know exactly what's going to be inside it, although there's been plenty of legal proceedings that have taken place since the launch of it, so we get an idea of where they're looking. My question is more of the political implications of it. Is this something that could move the needle one way or the other in favor or against President Trump? Ken?
I don't know. You know something? I was thinking the same thing. I've been thinking the same thing for the longest time, that what if the Mueller report comes out, it's a real damning indictment, small I indictment of the president and the people who work for him and his campaign. What if his supporters just say, well, it's fake news. It's a witch hunt. It's all fake information. It's part of the FBI Justice Department cabal against President Trump. So if you're asking Michael about the political implications, if his supporters don't move, aren't changed by it, and if the Republicans in Congress aren't affected by it, then ultimately what happens? Now, again, I'm assuming a lot of things. We don't know what Mueller is going to come up with, but I'm saying if it is damning and his side says, well, it's fake news, then we're back to where we started, and then we just have to make a decision in November of 2020.
Yeah, Howard, I mean, what percentage of voters out there is really up for grabs in terms of being possibly moved by the implications of the Mueller report?
I don't know. I mean, there was a poll the other day that had about 50% of the people were saying that this is, in fact, a witch hunt. But there was another 50% who said this is a legitimate investigation, and, we're...
What about the rest?
Yeah.
That's right. I'm kidding.
But so is there some movement there in the middle? Are they all dug in on that position, or is there 10 to 15%?
Michael, I think people are so dug in right now that I don't know how you get them out of their positions. Whatever Mueller has is going to have to be so strong, so locked tight that nobody could question it. But they will anyway.
The other question
is, what does Attorney General, Bill Barr, what does he release? What does he allow the American people to see? So that's another question.
Well, President Trump has come out and says, quote, I don't mind if it's released. I mean, frankly, I told the House, if you want, let them see it. Of course, he's also said that it's a witch hunt, that there should be no report at all. So if it looks like President Trump has given a sort of half-hearted or lukewarm endorsement of at least letting the public see what might be inside the Mueller report.
But he also said, he also promised that he would testify under oath before the Mueller investigators, and he's not doing that either. So there's a lot of things
right.
that the president will say and ultimately change his mind on.
So today's trivia question is, since World War II, what sitting senator got the highest vote percentage in November but failed to win the presidency? Let's go back to the phones. We've got Dave on the line. Hey, Dave, what's your guess?
How about opposition leader Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton.
Well, Hillary Clinton was the nominee in 2006. She wasn't the nominee in 2008, but she was a nominee in 2016. And by then, she was a former senator.
So in 2008, when she was actively a member of the Senate, she lost the Democratic primary. And so that's the qualifier here, is that she right. was most recently Secretary of State when she ran in 16. Good guess, Dave, but not the one we were looking for. 513-419-7100. If you'd like to take a guess, Ken Rune is waiting to give you a button, and you're going to want that button. All right, let's talk about Democrats.
It's a
for
nice
a minute.
Button.
So the list of presidential candidates continues to grow, though former Vice President Joe Biden still isn't on that list. But let's start with former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke. He's now in the race. Officially, he raised more than $6 million in 24 hours. That's pretty significant. Is this candidacy as hot as it looks?
I think it is up to a certain extent. Some people look at him and think he's kind of a gadfly, but he came to Cleveland last week. He got a good reception there, and he was smart enough politically to take a little side trip down to the Lordstown General Motors plant that's shut down that Donald Trump had promised he would never allow that to happen, and it did a few weeks ago, and met with the UAW president down there and scored a whole lot of points in the Mahoning Valley, which is the core of Donald Trump's strength in Ohio.
Let's go back to our trivia question real quick before we pick up that Beto comment. Since World War II, what sitting senator got the highest vote percentage in November but failed to win the presidency? We've got Tim on the line. What's your guess?
I'll say John McCain.
Hey, Ken, he says John McCain.
John McCain is a good guess. As a matter of fact, he's number two.
Oh,
on the list. If somebody came
missed.
Even closer, John McCain is a very good guess. He got 45.7% of the vote in 2008, but somebody came even closer.
Nice try, Tim. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Ian. Hey, Ian, what's your guess?
Is it Barry Goldwater?
Barry Goldwater.
Barry Goldwater was the sitting senator when he ran in 64, but he got clobbered by Lyndon Johnson, got about 38% of the vote, not Barry Goldwater.
Nice try, Ian. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Lamont. Hey, Lamont, what's your guess?
John Kerry.
John Kerry. Ken?
John Kerry is the correct answer.
Oh!
Yeah. All right.
How about that? Way to go,
hey,
Lamont.
John Kerry, 48.3% of the vote against President Bush in 2004. He came closer than any sitting senator since World War II.
And as always, hang on, Lamont, because in the control room, they'll take care of you and hook you up with, again, Ken. Tell him what he's won.
He's won a political junkie button, but if he can send you his email address, I will send him a photocopy of all my Lamont for Governor buttons. He's a new governor of Connecticut.
Yeah,
I won't send him the button. I won't send him the button, but I'll send him copies of the lot of different Lamont for Governor.
It's your lucky day, Lamont. Appreciate the call.
Do it, Lamont. Yeah.
All right. And as always, we pose the question to Howard. He doesn't get to see the answer. And he writes it down over here under my strict supervision to see if he's playing by the rules. And what'd you say?
Well, at first, I'll have to be honest, I thought it was Essex Kefauver.
Oh, wow.
But then I decided,
Who was never the nominee.
Yeah. Then I thought about it and said, wait a minute, he wasn't really the nominee.
Yeah.
And then I thought of Kerry, and Kerry was it. So
he got it.
I got it.
Howard Wilkinson, another winner today.
Lamont well and I got it.
Awesome. So
you have Wilkinson buttons from Kentucky, though, don't you?
Yeah, about that. Wallace Wilkinson from the early 90s. Good reference.
And remember Bud Wilkinson, the head football coach of the University of Oklahoma?
Oh,
he ran for the Senate in 1964, well remember, against Fred Harris.
There's no prominent Monkses out there. That's the problem.
There is.
You've got to work on that.
There is.
Really?
Monks ran for the Senate in Maine in 1964. 1972 against Margaret Chase Smith.
Wow.
You're incredible.
Well done.
I'll send you a copy of that, too.
Might have a cousin in Maine I'd like to visit.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember the Maine.
So, all right, Ken. So we were just talking about Beto. We got Howard's perspective on this. Is this guy for real?
Well, he is for now. I mean, what's fascinating about, I mean, there's so many things fascinating about Beto O'Rourke, because, you know, before he announced, you know, he was amazing. He was the next Barack Obama. He was the next Bobby Kennedy. He was going to unite the party. He was going to, you know, save the planet. And then once he announces, everybody says, well, you know, his resume is very thin, and he's very vague on policy proposals, and he feels he's entitled. And I heard he's a white man. I didn't know he was a white male until everybody said, you know, he's a white male. I never heard that as a criticism of a presidential candidate until just now. But on the other side, he has raised $6.1 million in 24 hours, as you said, which is more than any other candidate. He draws huge crowds wherever he goes. And while he may not be as progressive as some on the left of the Democratic Party would like, because, you know, he's not for, you know, Medicare for all and things like that, not Medicare for all, but I mean, I'm just saying he's not as far left as far as some of the other progressives like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or maybe even Kamala Harris. He's more of a centrist, but the question is, among the Democrats, do you want to a candidate who will touch your heart and make you feel good, or do you want somebody who could beat President Trump? And that's what the Democrats are wrestling with right now, and that's the same kind of thing they'll be wrestling with when Joe Biden gets in the race.
There's another candidate who's relatively new to national politics who seems to be surging at least in media attention, if not the polling. His name is Pete Buttigieg. He's the current mayor of South Bend, Indiana. So small town mayor, but he's gaining a lot of attention. He's also an openly gay man, which would be significant if he were to secure any nomination. Is he for real? Is he viable?
Well, I think he is. And you know something is interesting. Buttigieg is how you pronounce his name.
Thank you.
And the reason so many people
that often. Yeah.
Well, that's why people say just call him Mayor Pete,
because
right. It's much easier. But every time I've seen him, either on a serious news show or on like a Colbert kind of show, he seems very impressive. He knows what he's talking about. And yes, he'll be the first gay president, but he's also an Iraq war veteran. He has balanced budgets. I mean, he was reelected in a pretty conservative city. He seems to be the real deal. Now, you know, the last sitting mayor who became president was nobody. I mean, it's never happened. But and maybe one day he'll just drop out of the race and run for governor or the Senate, something like that. But right now, he is somebody to watch. He seems to be very impressive.
Yeah, I've been very impressed when I hear him speak. I mean, he is very good. He knows the issues. He can speak very well. I mean, I think he reaches people. This is not some guy who's the mayor of a small town and does nothing but fix potholes. You know, he understands the big national issues, and I think he has potential. You know, okay, we'll get used to pronouncing his name. You know, that's you can do that with money.
Yeah,
if he can raise enough money, and you know, and just keep saying the name over and over and over again, people will remember it.
Yeah, that reminds me of, you know, one of the great liberals of the 20th century is Birch Bayh, who died last week Indiana, former senator from Indiana. And he would come out with buttons, I'm bipartisan. And he had a song like, hey, look me over, let me a guy, his first name is Birch, let me an I, you know, my first name is Birch, his last name is Bayh. He also had trouble pronouncing his name, but I think Bayh seems to be much easier to pronounce than Buttigieg.
He could have been our first Bayh president, I guess. That could have been significant in a certain way. Okay, so former Colorado Governor John Hinkenlooper entered the race as well, but he appeared on CNN this week where he had to talk about taking his own mom to see the 1970s adult film Deep Throat. And when questioned about whether he would be open to a female vice presidential candidate to run with him, he said, of course. But then he asked the CNN host to ask more female candidates whether they would pick a man as VP. So maybe not a hot start out of the gate for Hinkenlooper, Howard?
No, probably not. You know, he's a different kind of guy. I mean, he has some Cincinnati connections, too. That Hinkenlooper family was very well known at one time in Cincinnati. But Yeah, he seems to have some problems. There was talk of him at one point running with John Kasich as a third party ticket. You know, that they were two guys who could, you know, pick up support. That's faded away. That's not going to happen. But I don't see him rising up out of the pack anytime soon.
Let's go to the phones. We have Kathy on the line. Hey, Kathy, how are you? What's your question? Hey, Kathy, are you there?
It's Jackie.
Oh, sorry. We misheard in the control room. They put it wrong. This isn't Kathy. This is Jackie. That's all right. We apologize for that. So, Jackie, what's on your mind?
My question is, wouldn't it, as a strategy, behoove the Democrats to actually maybe nominate a centrist? Because the East Coast and West Coast, where most of the progressives are going to vote for anyone other than Trump. But then potentially, if you nominate a centrist candidate, they're going to actually draw in more of the Midwest and Rust Belt as a result.
Jackie, which of the announced candidates for the Democratic nomination would you consider to be a centrist?
Well, as you were saying, maybe Beto O'Rourke, you know, seems to espouse to a more centrist, capitalistic ideal. And I think maybe he could fare better in the Midwest and the Rust Belt, win back some of the states that were lost in the last election, because they're going to vote. I mean, progressives are going to vote for anyone who's up against Donald Trump.
All right, Kathy, great comment. We'll let the guys answer. So that's her question. Ken, do you think that the Democrats would be better positioned in November of next year if they have a more centrist Democratic nominee?
That is absolutely the issue that is right before the Democratic Party right now. Do you want to follow the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing of the party, which is very angry and very energetic, and certainly very energetic? They helped elect so many new faces, including women and people of color, to Congress last year. But as Jackie rightly points out, the election was won and lost in 2016 in states like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Iowa. So do you want somebody who could do well in that Midwest, who's a moderate, who doesn't scare off the centrists? And that things you think of Beto O'Rourke, you think of John Hickenlooper is really running as a moderate. Amy Klobuchar has not, Sherrod Brown was going to be on that list too, had he run. Amy Klobuchar is also resisting polls to the left. And Joe Biden, I mean, whatever you think about Joe Biden, he's, you know, he's 76 years old, he'll be 77 in November. He has a history of saying things that may be out of step with the current Democratic Party, like the way he treated Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas hearings, his feelings about sentencing, things like that, and busing. He was against busing with that language that seems very incendiary compared to what it's like, what it is today. But it depends on if the Democratic Party, again, if you want to win, a lot of people think that being a centrist candidate is the way, but do you turn off the Bernie Sanders wing of the party? I noticed that Bernie Sanders' new press secretary, who he just announced as the press secretary, voted for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate in 2016. I mean, he picked somebody who wasn't even in the Democratic Party. So there are those divisions between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are still there, perhaps even more than ever, given so many choices. But that's what the Democratic Party has to decide.
Howard, let's get your thoughts on that. Should it be a more centrist candidate?
I believe it should be, really. If the point of this is to defeat Donald Trump and deny him a second term, the only way you're going to do that is with a centrist candidate who can appeal to those voters that Ken was talking about earlier in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, even Ohio, who went over to Donald Trump but could be won back by the right kind of a Democratic candidate. Now, I thought Sherrod Brown was a natural for that, but he's decided not to do this, not to run for the presidential nomination. Beto O'Rourke's a possibility. Klobuchar is a possibility. But I don't think that they can win this thing just by being mad at Donald Trump. They have to have somebody who is going to be a real alternative for those voters because they turned the election.
Ken, is the Democratic Party experiencing something like what the Republican Party went through after President Obama was elected, the Tea Party movement, and then suddenly there's this purity test for candidates? Is that what's happening on the left right now?
Absolutely. I mean, this is not a criticism of the left, but I think it's just, you know, they are true believers. The party clearly has moved more to the left. Look at Joe. I mean, again, the kind of statements that Joe Biden made during his 36 years in the Senate, it's an anachronism right now. And he's kind of either walked back a lot of his policies or apologized. And I mean, I don't think there was much ideological battles in the Republican Party in 2016. It seemed more about personalities, you know, Donald Trump or Jeb Bush or John Kasich. It seemed more about personalities. When I think of big ideological battles, I think of Goldwater versus Rockefeller in 64. I think of Reagan versus Ford in 1976. And the Democrats are going through that now, similar to what the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton battle went on then. I listened to what Howard's saying, and it makes a lot of sense. But if you have a centrist who's very, you know, you have a Joe Biden who, for example, calls Mike Pence a decent guy, I mean, that could drive the Bernie Sanders, you know, Elizabeth Warren, they could drive him crazy and saying, why vote Republican light? Look, I know that, Joe Biden is not Republican light and Beto is not Republican light, but there are litmus tests that we used to see in the Republican Party and sometimes still do that do exist on the Democratic side. And it could be, you know, it could excite the party and unite them against Trump, or it could have serious divisions that remain after the nominating convention.
We got a message on something that we talked about earlier, the Mueller report, and whether the public wants to see it. Brenton messaged to let us know that a recent Gallup poll shows 67% of the public wants the Mueller report released. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jeannie on the line. Hey, Jeannie, what's your question or comment? Is Jeannie there?
Yes.
Hey, Jeannie, what's your question?
I just said, as far as running mate, if you put a Biden, how would it work with a Biden? And as a vice president, a Beto O'Rourke or Biden and a Sherrod Brown as a vice president. How would that work?
Okay, we'll hang up and let the guys take a look. So she wants to know what you think the viability might be of a Joe Biden, Beto O'Rourke ticket, or maybe a Joe Biden and Sherrod Brown ticket. Howard?
Well, personally, I think it would be very viable. You'd have candidates who could get together on a message, number one, who would have name recognition, who could appeal to those voters I was talking about in some of those swing states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. And I think it would work. I mean, I think it could work. But, it's up to them.
And Ken, what do you think about having Joe Biden at the top of the ticket with somebody like Beto O'Rourke or somebody like Sherrod Brown?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts. First of all, I love the question from Jeannie, and it's a very important question. If you go on social media today, the new rumor is that Joe Biden's people have sent out outreaches to Stacey Abrams, the African-American woman who narrowly lost election for governor of Georgia last year.
She hasn't even conceded.
Right, she hadn't conceded, and she's also considering a run for president. We don't know if that's going to happen. But the thought, well, there's so many thoughts. First of all, given what the Democratic Party accomplished in 2018 with women and with people of color, can you have two white men? And again, I'm not trying to be racial here, but I'm just talking about practicality. Can you have two white men running on the ticket without a woman or without a person of color on the ticket, given the fact that you have a record number? You have six women running for president this year. You have several people of color. So that is fascinating. And two, if it's O'Rourke or Sherrod Brown as a running mate with Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, what does that say to the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the party, that, you know, the progressives don't matter? So I kind of think, because Joe Biden he's 76 years old. Let's be honest here. He's going to be a one-term president if he's elected. Whom he picks for a running mate is very crucial. And that's why I'm wondering, maybe he should announce it in advance. Very few people do that. And Ted Cruz picked Carly Fiorina, and that didn't go so well. But I mean, basically, he he should do it in advance to let people know who the future of the party would be. But if it's, again, if it's two white men, given what the Democratic Party is now looking like, that could be a mistake.
And Joe Biden ran for president when he was a senator from Delaware, both in 1988 and again in 2008. His own presidential campaign never really took off, but he got to serve as vice president under Barack Obama. So I wonder, his popularity within the Democratic Party now, that's got to be directly tied to the fondness for Barack Obama, Howard.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of it was, but a lot of it was his own backstory, his you know, the guy is a dynamic speaker. He's somebody who can rouse a crowd. You know, Joe Biden's good. He's good at what he does.
All right, let's go back to the phones. On the line, we have Lisa. Hey, Lisa, what's your question or comment?
Yes, my comment is about the idea that we need a centrist candidate in the next election. We actually lost the election last time with a centrist, and I feel quite soundly. And in the primary, and even lost in blue states, I think a number of things are concerning. This conversation that simply focuses on who can win, rather than what is needed. What do people really feel, want, believe, and what is needed? Just to come back to the old neoliberal policies, to me, is a real loser in the next election. And I think that we have to pay attention especially to young people.
Lisa, we appreciate the comment very much. So she's saying that, you know, focusing on centrist politics or focusing on who we think can win is not as important as finding somebody who can promote whatever the values are of that movement in the party. Let's go over to Judy. She's on the line. Hey, Judy, what's your question? Do we have Judy on the line? Okay, we might be able to come back to her. I think based on Lisa's comment, I want to reference some polls because we do have some polls now that are starting. We're obviously about a year away from any significant primary votes, but the polling has started. National polls from Emerson just yesterday has Joe Biden, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders tied at 26%. The only other two candidates within double digits are Senator Kamala Harris from California and former Congressman from Texas, Beto O'Rourke. She's at 12. He's at 11. So Biden and Sanders tied at 26. Harris and O'Rourke at 12 and 11. A CNN poll released on Tuesday showed former Vice President Biden with 28 percentage points and Bernie Sanders with 20. So that's got Biden up 8. And again, the only other two candidates within double digits are Kamala Harris out of California with 12 and former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke with 11. Morning Consult on Tuesday also had Vice President Joe Biden up by 8 points over Bernie Sanders, 35 to 27. So this is a national poll. But to Lisa's point, possibly, a Wisconsin poll by Emerson has Bernie Sanders up over Joe Biden by 15 points. Bernie Sanders with 39%, Joe Biden with 24%. And this is the first time you hear the name Senator Elizabeth Warren in double digits with 14. And Wisconsin is an important state because it went with President Trump last time in a surprise. So what does that tell us? If the national polls suggest that somebody with a more moderate or traditional Democratic voting record like Joe Biden is more popular with the general electorate, but then in those states that have got to go back to the blue column next time for them to win, are leaning towards these more progressive candidates. I'll start with you, Ken.
Well, first of all, I'm not criticizing anybody, but the fact that we're talking about polls in March of 2019 is driving me absolutely nuts. I mean, let me just say, at this point in 2016, the front runners in the polls were Scott Walker on the Republican side and Jeb Bush on the Democratic on the Republican side. The two front runners in 2016 were Scott Walker and Jeb Bush. In 2008, at this time, Hillary Clinton was the overwhelming front runner, just like Joe Biden is in national polls, and she lost to some skinny guy from Chicago. Rudy Giuliani was the front runner for the Republicans at this time in 2008. I think one of the reasons Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are doing so well in the polls is because everybody knows them. Joe Biden was a beloved vice president for 8 years. I mean, he's everybody's Uncle Joe, and as Howard said, there's a lot of reverence and great feelings for him. And Bernie Sanders, of course, took the country by storm in 2016, almost winning winning the Democratic nomination. People know him. Can I just go back? So that's how I feel about polls, but I don't want to ignore what Lisa said earlier because I think it's very important. I don't know. See, here's the thing. I don't know if Hillary Clinton lost because she was a centrist. She certainly was a very cautious candidate. She was very, very cautious about a lot of things. And that goes from her stint when she was first lady with her husband, who was also very centrist. I don't know if she lost because she was a woman. I don't know if she lost because she was that woman. So I don't know what lessons we learn from Hillary Clinton's defeat in 2016. But what I do know is that there's such an overwhelming feeling among so many Democrats that they've got to defeat Donald Trump that I think Part of the old ideological litmus tests go by the wayside because they want to know who wins. Now, I think, as I say, these polls are very misleading, and maybe you know Joe Biden won't wear well on the campaign trail. But I wouldn't worry. I wouldn't even focus on these polls. Let's see what happens once the debates start in June, and we'll see what the reaction is, and let's see how much money they raise. If Beto O'Rourke keeps raising $6 million, if Bernie Sanders keeps raising tons and tons of money, that could tell us a lot as well.
Well, in our last 90 seconds, I know we're already...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No, we're glad to hear what you said, and though it's awfully early to be talking about polls, it's even earlier to be talking about vice presidential candidates, but I want to bring that up in the context of Senator Sherrod Brown from here in Ohio. He was watched very closely, looked like he was flirting very heavily with getting in the race. Howard decided not to do that, but now he lies in wait.
Yeah.
Is he going to be considered for that number two spot?
Depending on who wins nomination, yes, I think he would be. You know, his.
Well, who's a better fit? You think, if in terms of who gets the nomination, who would Sherrod Brown fit better with? Do you think?
I don't know. I mean, somebody like Klobuchar, or somebody like Cory Booker, somebody like that. I mean, Cory Booker and Sherrod are very close already. And Sherrod's got that message of the dignity of work, which actually, you know, resonates pretty well with most voters because it's important. It's important, you know, places like Ohio and all of these so-called Rust Belt states.
So he must have had something that told him he couldn't win the nomination.
Yes, he did. And exactly what that is, I'm not sure. I don't want to say the word poll, so, but
because Ken would yell at you.
Yeah, he would yell at me, but no, I mean, he did a lot of polling, I know.
All right. I appreciate you both being here today. Howard Wilkinson, senior political analyst at WVXU, and the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Thanks so much for your insights today.
Kamala Harris and Sherrod Brown. That's the ticket.
There you go.
Harris and Brown, says the political junkie. All right. We'll see you next month. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show can be found online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.